Welcome to Shorties, a short true crime story.
Happy Monday.
Happy Monday.
I didn't get to spend the weekend with you. I know. How weird is that?
Do we typically spend our weekends together?
I mean, we see each other. We're like, you know, we do the dance. You know, we see each other in the morning and in the evening. Yeah. You know, do our own thing during the day.
Yeah, but I was out of town.
Yeah, she was out of town. And then I tried calling her today. Or when I tried calling her.
Okay, spoiler alert. This is Monday's episode, but we're doing it Sunday night.
Sorry. I can't lie, okay? I know. I tried calling her just to catch up because I hadn't seen her in, you know, days. It was unacceptable.
Well, I was driving back home from Northern California, so there was no reason for me to not have picked up her call, but I didn't pick it up, and then I called her back like 3 hours later.
Yeah, it gave me 3 hours to really think about anything and everything I possibly could have done to make her mad.
But in reality, I just missed it.
It was a healthy dose of anxiety.
I swear to God, I didn't realize you had called me.
Okay. I'll forgive.
So it's 1972 in the San Francisco Bay Area, and 15-year-old Susan Bowling is experiencing significant panic attacks after her parents' divorce. She was really struggling in high school, and she didn't feel like she fit in with anyone, and the whole experience was very isolating. Her teachers actually become so concerned about her mental health that they suggest that her mom take her to be evaluated by a therapist who specializes in adolescence, Dr. Felix Polk. So in traditional therapy, the role of a therapist is to present themselves as an impartial, non-reactive professional that guides you through struggles. Their goal is to create a safe space for you to work through things without judgment. So they don't tend to share personal opinions or like religious or political views and that sort of thing. But Felix approached his practice in almost the exact opposite way. He would overshare with his patients very personal details of his life. He let patients babysit his kids and openly expressed his feelings and opinions during sessions. He even invited them over to his home for dinner with his wife and kids. Like, I don't...
It's not ethical.
Everything about it is so... like,
it's wrong.
I can't wrap my head around any aspect of it. So Felix gained Susan's trust very quickly because, like her, he had also grown up feeling like he didn't fit in anywhere. Nazi Germany had invaded his homeland of Austria when he was only 9 years old, causing his family to flee. They successfully went into hiding for a few years in France before immigrating to the States in 1941. But the amount of trauma that he experienced left him feeling quite isolated in his own adolescence as well. So, of course, because he overshares, he's like, oh, you feel isolated? I was too. Apart from this, they also found that they had a lot in common in terms of their taste in music and literature, something that Susan always struggled with when it came to her peers because no one else at school was listening to classical music and reading books like Turgenev and Tolstoy. So you can imagine for Susan, bonding with someone over these things meant a lot to her, even if it was with her 40-year-old male therapist. And then after her parents' divorce, where she essentially lost her relationship with her dad, bonding with an older male figure went a long way. Their relationship became so meaningful to her that she didn't realize it was considered inappropriate as it slowly became more physical. She said it started out with small things like Felix would sit on the same couch with her rather than a separate seat. Then he would inch closer to her so their knees were touching. Then they started hugging hello and goodbye. Then they'd hold hands. And eventually they began having sex in their sessions. Now I want to be clear, you know, I know that she's 15, so sexual interactions between consenting adults is called sex. If an adult engages in sexual acts with someone underage, that's called rape. But I chose to state it as sex because she believed at the time that they were engaging in a consensual relationship. This went on for 5 years before Felix's wife found out and left him. And now that he's divorced and Susan is in her 20s, he and Susan acknowledge that they are in fact in a relationship and have been for several years. And when I first read that, I was shocked because I kept thinking, well, like, how did he not lose his license? Like, how do you admit that you're with your patient? And it turns out sleeping with your patients was frowned upon, but not actually illegal in California until 1992. Can you believe that?
No, I cannot.
So the most that they were admitting to is that he'd had an affair. However, the age of consent was 18 years old at the time. I verified that.
Yeah.
So they did lie about when it all started.
That reminds me of the thing about Dane Cook. And they were saying how, like, he's engaged to his long-term girlfriend. And she's 23. And they're like, well, we hope it's not that long-term.
Oh, that is yeah, nasty.
Real nasty.
Susan actually broke up with him not long after this. But he went into such a deep depression and alluded to her that if they didn't get back together, he would commit suicide. She was so heavily groomed and manipulated at this point that she caved and agreed to get back together. And then in 1980, when Susan was 24 and Felix was 50, they got married. Soon after the wedding, Susan gave birth to their son, Adam, followed by two more boys, Eli and Gabriel. So aside from the details we know now about Felix and how he got involved with his new wife, he was considered a very respected and successful psychologist. So while he continued focusing on his career, Susan threw herself into her new role as a stay-at-home mom. From the outside looking in, they seemed to have a very Norman Rockwell type of family. They lived in an affluent suburb called Orinda. They took vacations every year and drove nice cars. When the boys got older, they attended private schools and had lots of friends. However, Susan had a tendency to be irrational to the point that she was often paranoid. For example, during the infamous Satanic Panic of the 80s, Susan became convinced that their oldest son, Adam, communicated to her that he had been abused by Satan worshipers while he was at daycare.
Uh-oh.
However, Adam was only a year old at the time. Susan alleged that after being dropped off at daycare, Adam and the other kids would be packed up into a van and shuttled to a warehouse. The interior of the warehouse was set up with studio-grade lighting and cameras, and the children would be put into cages. Then Satan worshippers in robes and masks would sexually assault all of the kids and then sell the recorded footage to pedophiles. She even said that Adam specified that one time he watched these robed Satan worshipers force a small child into a trash bag and then they beat it to death with a hammer. He claimed that they then ate the dead child. So I want to be very clear for anybody who isn't familiar, one-year-olds can barely walk on their own, much less communicate all that Susan alleged that Adam communicated. If the one-year-old can talk, it's mostly gibberish with a real word or name thrown in here and there, but it's like dog and poop, you know,
mom.
It's, and mom. It's not like any, it's not Satan worshipers. It's not studio grade lighting. It's not but like all of the things. It's not pedophiles. And let's just say for argument's sake, this just occurred to me right now. How would he have known what they did with the footage?
Oh, that's a great point.
You know, it's just so crazy.
Can you imagine a one-year-old like specifying things, being like, look, mom, it was studio grade.
It would be terrifying.
This wasn't like what we got at home.
I know. But despite all of that, Susan was convinced that she could understand her young son. And so she started to coax him into telling her more about the Satan worshipers. If she managed to decipher a name from him, she would spend hours poring over the phone book, trying to find the person he was referencing. Then she would ask him about certain names that she found, thinking that he would be able to identify someone. And it's just delusional to think that a one-year-old would know the first and last name of someone that he may or may not have interacted with at daycare.
He doesn't even know his own first name and last name.
Totally, totally. So she would ask him about certain names that she found in the phone book, and if he gave her what she considered to be a signal that she had, in fact, found someone that had abused him, she would then write down the address of the person in question and go on to case the person's house for days on end in the hopes of catching suspicious behavior. The claims surrounding the Satanic Panic have never once been substantiated. It's completely made up. And while the alleged incidents that Susan claims Adam experienced are indeed horrific, it just didn't happen. Even if, God forbid, he experienced or witnessed something horrible, he would have been too small to even comprehend it, much less communicate it to anyone. So that whole story is really more about painting a picture of Susan's mental state. Felix seemed to believe these claims, so much so that he actually founded an organization called Enough, whose sole purpose was to pressure lawmakers into ending the satanic abuse of children. So it's like the blind leading the blind in this marriage. Susan then begins to tell people that she's being followed around by shadowy figures in their neighborhood, and she becomes more and more paranoid until Felix finally agrees to move to a new house. And the move seemed to help her mental state quite a bit, and things calm down. In the late 90s, Felix gets really into this idea of hypnotherapy as a way to help patients retrieve suppressed memories. The idea is that in childhood, the patient likely experienced a traumatic event that their brain then suppressed as a way to survive. And there was a lot of controversy around the validity of this and a lot of accusations of therapists feeding ideas to patients. But you know Felix, he doesn't approach his practice in any type of normal manner. So, of course, he tells Susan that she needs to try this, and she does it, but nothing happens for a while. Their kids are now in middle school and high school, so they're old enough to notice things about their mom that they don't see other moms doing. For example, Susan would obsessively search for coded messages in newspapers and magazines. So not very long after trying that hypnotherapy exercise, the family takes a trip to Disneyland where Felix claims that Susan had a psychotic break when all of her suppressed memories bubbled up to the surface. She began sobbing uncontrollably, and she told Felix that she remembers her brother attacking her once, then another memory where she claimed her father sexually assaulted her in childhood, and then the wildest one, she claimed that she remembered witnessing her parents beat a police officer to death with a hammer. Then she claimed to remember details of her childhood that proved that her parents were not her real parents. And out of all the alleged memories, this was the only one that she could prove through like a DNA test. So she does a test, but all it does is tell her that her parents are in fact her biological parents. So aside from this, everyone treats her other alleged memories as being real, which is really crazy because she accused her parents of murdering someone and everyone just accepts that and moves on.
Especially coming from someone that's, I mean, very noticeably mentally ill.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. She's married to this very well-respected, successful psychologist who is not viewing it as mental illness, and he just tries to support her, and so it's...
How scary is it, the fact that he's the person you go to when you are mentally ill, and all he's doing is enabling and denying the presence of something that's very dangerous?
Uh-huh,
yeah. That stuff scares me.
Yeah, but he also, like, raped his... teenage patient.
So I forget. Like, he is unethical. Know. Yes. Yeah. Yes. I forget. Yes. We don't actually like him.
He is the epitome of unethical. So it's around this time that Susan realizes it was wrong the way her relationship with Felix developed. So while she is clearly dealing with undiagnosed mental illness, she did at least have one huge aha moment of clarity and saw something for what it really was. Regardless of whether or not you can put stock in any of her other alleged suppressed memories and all of the other things that she's doing, there was no denying that she now believed with 100% certainty that when she was 15 years old, Felix hypnotized her, raped her, and then manipulated her into marrying him and having his children.
I wonder if a little bit of that came up because she now has children that are close to her age at the time.
Oh, I didn't even think about that, but I bet you.
And like seeing absolutely. The world through, it's like you're your baby at 15.
Definitely. She later said that this realization that she had been manipulated into marrying her rapist caused a deep depression. She then began questioning if she was crazy or if her psychologist husband had made her doubt her own sanity all this time. I mean, that's so hard to say, but I do wonder.
Did he see this all along?
And did he add to it? Did mm-hmm. he, you know, I don't know. I mean, when you're groomed from the time that you're 15 years old, groomed by this man that you trust so implicitly the way that we trust our therapists, I don't know.
Your brain is so vulnerable and that's like you're forming. You're still forming at 15.
Yeah. And clearly there's nobody else there looking out for her. So she's just completely at his mercy.
It's horrible.
So she wondered, you know, had he been gaslighting her and feeding into crazy notions? She had no way of knowing, but she knew that she couldn't trust him anymore, and so she asked him to move out. He moved into the detached pool house at the back of the property, and then for the next year, Susan claimed to remember more and more about Felix. She alleged that he had been a spy for the CIA in the past and that he had tried recruiting her as a spy too. And then she became convinced that he was trying to poison her. So she refused to eat or drink anything that he brought into the house or that he might have touched or handled in any way. In early 2001, the police were called to the Polk home several times, with both Felix and Susan accusing the other one of domestic abuse. During the last visit, Susan got upset when the police did not arrest Felix. So she slapped him across the face in front of the officers and said, "Okay, then you can take me to jail now." Felix got a restraining order against her, and she moved to Montana. She told him that she wanted to start over somewhere else, and she chose to leave their kids behind with their dad. For the next few months, the boys were alone with their dad, and they told him how much Susan had tried to turn them against Felix. They even said that for a few months before she left for Montana, she openly talked about all the ways in which she could murder him, like running him over with a car or killing him with a shotgun. When the judge in their divorce proceedings gave Felix custody of their youngest son and ordered Felix to pay Susan $1,500 in alimony versus the $7,000 a month that she was expecting, she was furious and convinced that everyone conspired against her. She believed that Felix had turned the judge against her and, worse, that he had turned her own son against her. Susan then writes and mails letters to the FBI, the CIA, and the judge in their proceedings where she states that she has psychic abilities, she claimed to have predicted the 9/11 terrorist attacks, and she claimed to have warned her husband, you know, given that she believed that he was a spy for the CIA, and that because he didn't do anything to stop the attacks, we can all blame 9/11 on him. In early October of 2002, Susan returns to the family home in California for a dental procedure and to remove the last of her items from the place. She told Felix to stay in the guest house so that she could stay in the main house, and that if he didn't obey her orders, she would blow his head off. She arrives at the home on October 9th, and then early in the morning of October 13th, Felix and 15-year-old Gabriel took a five-hour road trip to return Adam, the oldest, to his dorm at UCLA in Southern California. After getting Adam settled in, Felix and Gabriel made the five-hour drive back to Northern California in the same day. They got home really late, they said goodnight, and Gabriel went to bed in the main house, and Felix went off to bed in the pool house where he was staying since Susan was still in town. The next day, Monday, October 14th, Gabriel went to school like normal. He met Susan for lunch around 12:30, and then she dropped him off at home before heading out to run errands. He said it was kind of odd to him that she didn't run the said errands while they were already out, but he didn't really give it much thought because he needed to get ready anyways. Felix was planning to come home early from work to take Gabriel to a baseball game. Gabriel got ready, he showered, he's sitting around the house, and Felix was late. He starts calling his dad, but he can't reach Felix at work, so he just sits and waits because this is 2002, so I don't know that his dad had a cell phone. Susan returns to the house around 7 p.m. and makes dinner. By 8:30, Gabriel is freaking out. This is so unlike his dad and so concerning given that they had been looking forward to going to this game together and they had planned it so far in advance and his dad was supposed to be home at like 3 p.m. Like
It's not usual behavior.
It was really, really concerning. So when he told his mom that he was worried, she just looked at him blankly and said, "Maybe he was in an accident. Why don't you call Highway Patrol?" And he said that there was just something in her delivery that gave him chills. So he decides to walk over to the pool house, but the door was locked and the lights were out. And, you know, his dad's car isn't here anyway. So he goes back to the kitchen where Susan is cleaning up and asks her point blank if she knows where Felix is. And she responded, "He's gone. Aren't you happy?" And so Gabriel keeps asking again and again and again, and she just keeps responding, "Aren't you happy?"
I would run.
Yeah. And finally, she laughs and says something about not needing a shotgun after all. And that's when Gabriel's blood runs cold, and he runs. He bolts it upstairs into his bedroom, and he locks the door. But just as he's about to call 911, It occurs to him that her remarks might be just more of the same crazy things that she's been saying for years and years and years. But something pulls him to the pool house. So he grabs a flashlight and marches outside again. Because he's like, I don't know what emergency I'm going to tell the operator. Mm-hmm. I don't know if he's really missing. It's totally possible he forgot about the game. It's possible that he's tied up at work. There's all these different things. What am I supposed to say? My dad is late to take me to a baseball game.
He just knew something was wrong though.
Yeah. So he goes outside. But this time he goes around to the back and he finds an unlocked door. He walked slowly into the dark space. And soon his flashlight illuminates his father's body, covered in blood and unmoving on the floor. Gabriel bolts outside and hides from his mom behind the garage where he calls 911. When the police arrive and confirm that 70-year-old Felix is deceased, one of the officers relays it to Susan. And her response was, oh well, we were getting a divorce anyways. So Susan was placed under arrest and charged with the murder of her husband. In the beginning of her court proceedings, Susan chose to represent herself, which is what all sane people do.
Yeah, not a good sign.
She initially denied killing him, but eventually admitted to it. However, she claimed it was self-defense. The coroner determined that Felix had been stabbed over 20 times with a combination of fatal wounds to his midsection and defensive wounds on his hands and arms. I watched an interview with Susan on YouTube and she was like, people say that I stabbed him 27 times, but I only stabbed him 4 to 6 times.
Okay, that's what's important here.
Yeah, and she really says it like that, like, can you believe it? And it's important to note that because she's claiming self-defense, she had no injuries or defensive marks on her body at all. Susan claims that shortly after Gabriel and Felix returned on the 13th, she went to the pool house to speak to Felix about finances. She claims that he attacked her with a knife, but somehow she overpowered him and stabbed him so that he wouldn't stab her first. She said when he stopped moving, she washed his blood off of her and then sat on the ground and waited for the police to arrive. She thought killing him would mean the police just automatically show up afterwards.
Okay.
And when that didn't happen, she cleaned up a bit more, walked back to the main house and went to bed as if nothing had happened. The next day, after she made Gabriel breakfast and sent him off to school, she drove Felix's car to the nearest train station to make it look as though he had gone to work like normal. She said that she feels bad that Gabriel found him, but she just hadn't figured out what to do with his body by then. Susan's antics in court were ridiculous, so when a local defense attorney named Dan Horowitz reaches out to her, she agrees to let him represent her. And 3 years after Felix's murder, Susan's trial officially begins. On Saturday, October 15th, 2005, only a couple of days after the anniversary of Felix's death, Susan's attorney, Dan, spent the day at his office prepping for that upcoming week's cross-examinations. It wasn't unusual for him to spend a Saturday at work, especially with such a high-profile trial. But that evening, as he drove home, he realized it was odd that he hadn't heard from his wife, Pamela, all day. When he pulled into the driveway, he was surprised to see Pamela's car there. She had had plans to go to the ballet that evening with a friend, and she should have been gone by now. But when he gets to the front door to find it's not only unlocked but ajar, he realizes that something is wrong and rushes inside, where he tragically finds his wife's body in the entryway, curled into the fetal position, covered in blood. He frantically called 911, but she had died hours before from multiple stab wounds. The press started speculating that the two cases were connected because both victims had been stabbed to death and both victims had lived fairly close to one another. And then this speculation was only fueled by Susan's delusional rants to reporters. She insisted that Felix's spy friends from the CIA had targeted Pamela as a way to scare Susan. But as it turns out, a 16-year-old neighbor of Dan and Pamela's had decided to grow marijuana plants in his closet, but he couldn't afford the equipment, so he came up with the idea to open a credit card in his neighbor's name. Then he decided to have the order shipped to another neighbor, which turned out to be Pamela, to try to cover his tracks. But when the company became suspicious that the name and billing address was completely different from the recipient's name and address, they wouldn't release the order until speaking with Pamela directly. The police believed that the teenager went to Pamela to threaten her into cooperating, and that when she refused, he stabbed her to death. It became clear pretty quickly that the two murders were unrelated, but it made Dan's ability to continue with Susan's case basically impossible. Given how close both crime scenes were to each other, there was just too much overlap with like the forensics and police and stuff. For example, the coroner who performed Felix's autopsy had also performed Pamela's. And this created a huge conflict of interest given that Dan had planned to call that coroner as a witness in Susan's case. So a few days after Pamela's murder, the judge declared a mistrial and removed Dan as Susan's attorney. He advised her to find a new attorney in preparation for the next trial. But what does she do? She goes back to representing herself. So without getting into the details, Susan acting as her own representation gave the court a very clear view into her fragile state of mind. I mean, not only was she not an attorney, but she was clearly mentally ill. So choosing to represent herself really only sealed her fate, in my opinion, because if you look at the court transcripts and stuff, it's like, girl, oh no.
Yeah.
The biggest witness in the trial were actually Felix and Susan's sons, who were by this point aged 23, 21, and 19. Adam and Gabriel, the oldest and youngest, believed that their mom was guilty and they testified against her. They had even filed a wrongful death suit against her because they feared that she would blow all of their inheritance on legal fees otherwise. But the middle son, Eli, was all Team Susan. He believed that his dad had been drugging and hypnotizing their family for years before his death. Gabriel's testimony against Susan was damning. He shared in detail what it was like to grow up with a mentally ill mother who openly fantasized about killing his dad on almost a daily basis. Susan kept him on the stand for 5 days before the judge finally ordered her to end her examination because it was bordering on abuse. The jurors later said that it seemed like she was determined to have Gabriel admit that she was a good mom rather than focus on proving her innocence. But the final nail in the coffin came when Susan called herself to the witness stand. She rambled delusions for days on end, attempting to share her life story with the jury. But in reality, she continually undermined herself by claiming Felix was a spy for the CIA and that he had ignored all of her predictions of worldly disasters and famous murders. In July of 2006, over 4 years after Felix's death, Susan was found guilty of murder in the second degree and sentenced to 16 years to life in prison. And the latest that I could find was that during her parole hearing in 2019, she was so disruptive that she had to be removed halfway through. So she was obviously denied parole and won't have another hearing for 10 years. While no one deserves to be murdered, and it's very clear that Susan struggled with significant mental illness, I want us to remember how they met and how their relationship developed. Susan was a child who needed help, and Felix, the adult being paid to help her, took advantage of her. So I do believe that she's a victim in this as well, but I think the real victims to focus on are Adam, Eli, and Gabriel, who lost both of their parents on the same night. And that is the story of Susan and Felix Polk.
A lot of thoughts. It's just the most vulnerable place in which you can possibly put yourself. The brain is such a delicate thing.
Yeah.
And when you're a youth, you can't weigh not even the pros and cons, but like the possibilities. You don't have perspective. You don't know that you're literally at the mercy of this adult to put any idea into your brain. And that is like, it's the biggest nightmare.
Now as an adult and you look back on your youth.
Yeah.
It's easy to remember you felt like an adult and you felt like everything mm-hmm. was your choice. You didn't, you know, when you're young, you're just craving independence and autonomy yeah. and you just think that you're making choices for yourself.
Yeah.
And when there's nobody there present intervening and saying, this is actually wrong. I can't have you in this situation. It's easy to become prey. And then now as an adult, when you look back at that time, you're like, no, you are a child. You are literally a child.
I felt more independent and mature, like adult, then, like in middle school, than I do now at 30. And I don't know why. And I think a lot of that is a lack of perspective.
Yeah, a lack of life experience and understanding of the world.
Well, thank you so much for telling us that story.
Thank you for listening to it.
No prob. Love you.
I love you.
Bye.
Bye.
If you enjoyed this episode, please rate, review, and subscribe wherever you enjoy listening. We owe everything to the many journalists, authors, filmmakers, psychiatrists, and psychologists whose extensive work and expertise we pulled from to share this episode with you. To view detailed source material, as well as content from today, please visit us on Instagram and TikTok at Shorty's Podcast. We really love doing this show, and if you'd like to help with the continued creation of it, you can support by donating to our Patreon, patreon.com/shortiespodcast. This episode was hosted by Ashley Brumley Johnson and Anna Katharina.